fields of bodies burning as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
Hi, this is Bob Petrakis bringing you the other side of the news.
And I'm Dan Dugan, the other guy on the other side. WGRN, the Green Renaissance.
This is the other side of the news. I'm Bob Petrakis here with the other guy.
The other guy's Dan Dugan, still wondering, what about Tuesday?
But what about Tuesday and what about Bob?
What about Bob on Tuesday? What about Bob post-Tuesday and what Bob thinks about elections?
Well, I think a hard rain's going to fall, particularly on Mr. Trump.
Yeah, well, the House continues to, the Dems continue to pick up seats in the House, the U.S. House. But Ohio is just a wipeout. The red wave hit at home, that's for sure.
Well, whatever happened in Ohio, and the question is what the lesson is from there, but the Republicans won all five statewide offices. They won the gubernatorial election by much more than predicted. Yeah, the
In fact,
some of the last polls showed Cordray winning. But I think that last second trip up to Cleveland. And there was a big debate.
Last second trip up to Cleveland
by the El Presidente. Donald Trump.
Trump
went up there,
Okay.
But was really, and here was the big debate. Paul Ryan was saying, look, go with economics. Go with, you know, the greatest economy in modern times.
Yeah.
That whole rap. But Trump stuck with immigration and hordes
that caravan,
of people.
Right.
Which apparently
your poor, tired, huddled masses
in
that we don't want anymore.
Right. It seemed to work here. But also many of arguing because you know, they lost the attorney general's office, you know, Dettelbach and Yost. Mm-hmm. They lost the secretary of state's office as well. And again, sadly, you know, and Ms. Clyde was a great candidate, and they lost the treasurer's office. But here's one of the possible lessons.
I was wondering if the current secretary of state had anything to do with why.
Actually, Ohio,
both seem so.
Ohio had voters reinstated in court. Ohio, you know, Georgia was the new Ohio.
Okay. All right.
I mean, people would show up in Georgia, and they'd have voted for 40 years, and their name was gone.
Do you trust the results in Ohio, I guess?
Well, there was no massive reporting of vote hopping, of vote shifting. You can never fully understand them because of the programming. But they were close enough to the margin of error. I mean, the sad part about all these races is that they were relatively close, and we don't have to blame the purging of the voter list because a federal judge, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, a three-judge panel reinstated the voters. The lesson that some people are claiming is in a battleground state, you don't win as a centrist. The only person on the ballot that won statewide and won, you know, quite handily by, you know, 8-9 points was Sherrod Brown.
Who also, by the way,
who was also
the media,
farthest left.
Which
was
great.
Right. He was the most progressive candidate.
Yeah.
He's been with the
Metzenbaum was.
The lesson may be in Ohio, in a purple battleground state. DeWine's moving to the right with Trump, you don't then become the kind of moderate, just left, just right of center Democrat.
In a world of Lucy's and Snoopy's, don't be Charlie Brown.
That's right. And to some
extent, crazy
I think
that.
That's what Cordray was. And and again, Sherrod Brown,
centered.
A lifelong progressive, stayed. He didn't move to the center. He stayed with his progressive populist values, jobs for people in Ohio.
Right.
and he won.
Huh. Okay. Well, I would like to hear more about the national elections, the other elections like the ones that are still apparently being contested in Georgia, Florida, Arizona, for instance. We don't have a lot of time because we have a great guest today. But would you like to discuss those elections? I mean, I think it's great that the Democratic candidate in Georgia did not concede.
Well, Harvey Wasser and I wrote a article saying, you know, in close elections, nobody should really concede until you do a recount, until you look into them.
Right.
And the recount should be more than because some of these right. machines don't have paper.
Yeah.
In some cases, you want to do a forensic analysis of the source code
right.
To make sure, because in Georgia and in Texas in particular, where Ted Cruz won, I mean, they clearly had programmed the machines wrong. You know, if you voted a Democratic Party straight ticket, it went all Democrats except for Republican Senator Cruz. I mean, the Houston Chronicle
Whoa.
Wrote about that. That's what we
Wow.
call a calibration problem. And there were some reports in places like Georgia and Texas that people would push and it wouldn't record.
Right.
That, again, is a calibration problem. We had this in Ohio in 2004, that often to vote for Kerry, if you pushed on his name,
so
it wouldn't come up. You had to push slightly above his name.
And the calibration problems in Texas is leaned red, in other
yes,
words.
Yes, they did, as they did in
blue.
Georgia.
Yeah.
So right. any time, you know, if it's going in either direction, makes more sense. Any time it's going only in one direction, somebody, either by accident
right.
or design, has programmed the computers wrong. It's what you call the ballot configuration, right? You put this... You have this ballot up on the screen, but if you push here, all Dems, and one of the votes goes to Cruz,
yeah.
It's wrong. You've calibrated
right,
it wrong. The ballot configuration
was
is
that
wrong.
Rampant in Texas enough to
numerous
sway
reports.
The...
I mean, the Houston Chronicle, the election officials admitted to it,
right.
just like in 2004 in Youngstown,
they
admitted 31 machines. You pushed for Kerry,
right.
it jumped to Bush. Also
right.
in Franklin County in 2004, we had the Franklin County fade, which was another variation. You push for Kerry, right? And so you voted for all Dems. You look at your ballot at the end. All of the votes are there except Kerry's, which has faded away.
Well, but what I really, what bothers me, and this is what we've discussed before, is that Kerry conceded in
Absolutely.
2004. Gore conceded in 2000. The guy in Florida, was it the Senate race? He conceded. Okay, so there the onus is back on. And O'Rourke conceded, correct?
Right.
Whereas the woman who ran for governor in Georgia has not conceded. So does she have a better chance of turning it around, I guess?
Well, yeah. Well, when you concede, it's all over, right? It's in the hands of the election
not
officials.
Not entirely, but yes.
Well, I mean, it's, you know.
But the burden is on you. Then,
right. The assumption is that if you're not going to fight for it.
Right. There you go.
Is
see,
that
that's,
you
that's
can't expect the election officials to fight for it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're into getting the election results out and doing the minimum amount of work.
All right. Okay.
But, you know, if you don't concede, you can get your observers in there. You can look at anything that's on paper. Unfortunately, 40% of the votes in Ohio aren't on paper.
Uh-huh.
But
right.
With
exactly.
that in mind, there are a lot of things at stake, including the Board of Elections throwing off the fracking initiative
yeah, no kidding.
In the city of Columbus.
Yeah, just clean
but
water is
clean
all we
water
want.
Is
yeah.
a and prevalent air. Issue, and to get some insights on that, maybe
mm-hmm.
we should turn to our guest, Eugene Beer.
Eugene Beer.
Hello, everyone.
Good to have you here. You don't have your piano and bicycle.
Not today. It's a little
so
bit
it's hard
snow.
For me to recognize you right away. But anyway, you've got a lot to talk about. But what
yeah.
did you think about the elections?
Well, I think we're designed to take a well.
Oh,
we
need to say
poem.
WGRN.
Yes.
There you go. The Other Side of the News, Dr. Bob and Dan. Eugene.
Yeah, so we've probably heard a lot about the dangers of fracking near the wells, the actual wells, mm-hmm. you know, people's water being polluted and catching on fire, stuff like that.
Sure.
But I had the opportunity at the end of October to attend a court trial in the small town of Cortland Manor, New York. That's in Westchester County, right near Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant. Mm-hmm. And the trial was concerning three activist defendants who had crawled into the pipeline when it was under construction in 2016. And they were attempting to slow down the construction or hopefully stop it, because this particular pipeline is called the AIM, A-I-M pipeline, Algonquin Intermarket Pipeline.
Huh.
This pipeline goes 105 feet.
Those initials sound familiar. But anyway.
American Indian Movement.
Thank you.
105 feet this pipeline traverses from the Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant property. Mm. Now, as you can imagine, gas pipelines are very highly pressurized, mm-hmm. particularly fracking gas pipelines. They use the latest technology to run that gas through as fast as they can, because there's a lucrative overseas market for our fracked gas now.
Sure.
And they get higher prices overseas. So this particular pipeline goes over into New England, coastal cities, where the excess of it that's not used in the U.S. is liquefied and sent on tankers
on
overseas.
Yeah.
They get a darn good price. So they were anxious. This was Spectra was the pipeline company, an offshoot of Duke Energy, which I think we know was responsible for this coal ash spill in North Carolina a few years ago. Anyway, so these guys were under, actually, a man and two women, young women, were under trial. And the judge, who was a young woman, basically used to hearing traffic violations, she actually accepted a climate necessity defense for these witnesses.
Climate necessity.
Yeah, climate necessity means that the defendants were able to call climate experts and risk assessment experts involving pipeline ruptures and nuclear plants in proximity. They were able to call these witnesses to testify for pretty much 2 hours for each witness to testify. And the expert witness I'm going to talk about, his name is Paul Blanche, and he's been a nuclear engineer for many years, but lately has spent time on assessing pipeline risk in the proximity of nuclear plants. So he came and testified, and he showed us the map of how close this pipeline came to the Indian Point plant, and it's within about 300 feet of the so-called switchyard of the nuke plant. Now, the switchyard is where all those electrical lines come into the plant
sure.
and go out of the plant. Mm. Turns out, if that switchyard is bombed, or if it's destroyed by a blast, the incoming electricity obviously won't be there anymore, and the nuke plant can't operate if there's not grid energy coming in to run its pumps to cool the water storage
area.
Well,
this can't be good if it's not being cooled.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened in Fukushima. The Fukushima plant was not compromised so much by the tsunami force. It was by the fact that the power went out, and the generators were also compromised by being underwater. So that nuclear pool of stored rods, spent fuel rods, overheated and exploded with hydrogen explosion and caused all kinds of radiation. So a similar situation could happen at Indian Point if, in fact, this pipeline were to rupture, which he gave a probability of pipeline rupture. Historically, it's about 6 chances out of 10,000 per mile per year.
Okay.
Now you think, well, that's kind of a small number. But think what could happen
sure.
if it did rupture. The typical rupture, common occurrence mm-hmm. of a rupture is what's called a guillotine rupture. So imagine a guillotine cutting through this steel pipe. What happens is the welds fracture because of corrosion
off
and other things.
Heads.
Yeah. The weld's flash fracture in the pipe severs in two, and boom, you've got an explosion of 1,000 pounds of pressure per square inch venting into atmospheric pressure. And this explosion is so violent that it often ignites the gas, okay? Mm. And that you get a huge fireball. In this fireball, he did a calculation that in the first 2 minutes of this fireball, you get the equivalent of a Hiroshima bomb's worth of energy, of heat energy released in the first 2 minutes of that fireball. And here it is, about 15 kilotons of TNT equivalent. So this is enough to go out about 4,000 feet from the blast and affect even the control room where people are residing, operating this nuclear plant. And it probably wouldn't affect the actual containment structure of the nuclear fission reaction. That would be okay, but it would affect the power, and that would cause everything to madly try to shut down.
Right.
And that's, again, what happened at the Three Mile Island, shutdown problems, and at Fukushima.
And this is how close to how many millions of people?
So. This is within 40 miles of 20 million people, including all of New York City. Now, the danger to the New York City area is not a blast. It is radiation caused by compromising of the cooling of these spent fuel rods. And that radiation would be similar to what's happening at Fukushima even to this day. This radiation will go on for maybe hundreds of years, thousands of years. It would basically make New York City uninhabitable for 1,000 years. So that's kind of the short of it. It's a risk.
Only 1,000.
Yeah. I think the bottom line with this risk assessment is that the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, listened to the pipeline company, Spectra Energy, as to the timing that it would take to shut off the gas in case of a pipeline rupture, and they were told 3 minutes. 3 minutes, said the pipeline company, is how long it takes us to shut off the gas to prevent this fireball from continuing on. Well, in fact, our nuclear engineer that testified analyzed 912 rupture incidents with pipelines. The shortest time to turn off that gas in all cases was 30 minutes. The longest time was more than 24 hours.
Yeah, and again, in those situations, I mean, you have the famous Fermi 2, the book, you know, We Almost Lost Detroit. When the rods were close to melting down there, everyone raced to the parking lot, got in their car, and was doing 100 miles up 75. I mean, one guy stayed and pulled the rod, and had he not, it had been a complete meltdown. You know, I mean, what did you say? I mean, it's essentially a Hiroshima blast when it explodes.
Yeah, when
where are they shutting it off from? I mean,
that's the problem.
Who's getting close to it?
That's the problem. When they shut it off, it has to be done at one of these compressor stations, and they're 25 miles separated. So it could be on average, you know, 10, 15 miles away where they shut it off.
Do they have people just sitting there waiting? That's their whole job?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
No, they have sensors.
Homer Simpson sleeping.
They have sensors that detect a pressure loss, but these sensors actually don't notice it right away because the pipeline is so fat, 42 inches, it takes sometimes 20 minutes for the sensor to say, oh, we have a pressure loss, something's going on, and then they have to isolate where the pressure loss is. It could be upstream or it could be downstream, and that takes usually an hour, not 3 minutes.
Not 3 minutes,
I mean, it reminds me of Georgia Pacific in Columbus. They had this whole system. You know, these things would go off, and they'd let you know when there was too much pressure, and someone could go down there and release the valve. The reality is the sensors. So by the time they notified people, the pressure was so high, no one went down to do a manual release, and in fact, the plant blew up.
Because
it takes a while. You have these sensors, they're not always going to work correctly, and it's risky. I mean,
And in all 900 cases of these anomalies with leaking, it was not the sensors that notified the company. It was people in the area calling 911.
There's a fireball!
Wow.
a big old fireball. Well, the sensors haven't notified us yet. It should
right,
be okay.
Right.
Wow. Amazing. So
the fact is this pipeline has been built and it is in operation.
Oh, okay.
So they weren't able to stop it.
And it's real close to a
Governor Cuomo's house, actually.
So the protesters
to the switchyard.
So the protesters had a right to protest based on the environment, but they didn't stop it based on the environment.
Correct.
Right?
And they have yet to be sentenced. They're going to be sentenced in January, so we'll see what that result is this coming January. They put up a very good defense.
Yeah.
And again, it's really up to the judge on necessity. And in U.S. history, there's been perhaps the most famous necessity defense was Amy Carter with Abby Hoffman, who were actually acquitted. They went in and shut down a CIA recruitment on campus at Brown and used the necessity defense, said, look, the CIA is involved in the mass killing of people in El Salvador and in other third worlds. We were required to protest to save people's lives. Jury bought it.
Yeah.
But so again, though, I mean, so the protesters, right, they're still, you know, waiting sentencing, and yet the pipeline's built, and we just wait to see if it's safe. I mean, right?
I'm impressed the judge allowed the necessity defense. Some judges,
I am too.
Particularly in Ohio, Madeline Fitch, who chained herself down to an injection well, you know, an old injection well. We tried to bring that up. Connie and I were her attorneys, and they wouldn't allow us to go down the road of necessity.
Yeah.
But we did come up with a good deal with for anyway. And
but the good news is that Indian Point is scheduled to shut down anyway in 2021 or 2022. However,
as a result of
independent of the pipeline, just danger to New York City, terrorism, obsolescence, but also it turns out that the storage pool, okay, that's going to take 5 to 10 additional years to dry cask highly radioactive spent fuel rods. So there's still the danger to the city of New York for that additional 5 to 10 year period after it shuts down until they're dry cask. And then they're pretty much explosion resistant.
Well, it seems like one of those things like Fukushima. It's like, let's store the radioactivity on the roof. We'll be okay unless there's a tsunami and an earthquake. But in this case, it's the switchyard, right?
Yeah.
Let's put a gas pipeline right by where all the important electrical connections are. So if it blows up, there'll be no way to cool the radioactive rods and they'll melt down.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't it a fundamentally flawed design? I mean, you're an engineer, are you not?
I am, and I'm just amazed they allowed this. It just boggles the mind.
Yeah, now when you're in engineering school, I'm thinking, what if you'd have written that up? What if we did it this way? We run the gas right by all the electricity, so if it blows up, it takes the whole grid out.
But meanwhile, Japan, as a result of Fukushima, basically has gotten away from nuclear energy, right? Isn't that the case? But we here in the greatest country,
continue to
just sit on the powder keg and wait. Right?
Well, there's
a lot of economic forces that keep us going with nuclear energy.
I hear you, but hasn't Japan pretty much phased out?
I know it's been reduced a lot. I don't know if it's totally been phased out.
Okay. But we know in Germany, right? Germany is the great with the rooftop solar.
Oh, absolutely.
Right, and when they came there and said, "Hi, we need some more nukes," they said no. You're going to finance rooftop solar, and then the stuff coming back in, you'll benefit by cheaper energy on the grid. So, I mean, they've taken nuclear plants that were proposed to be built, and instead they've got, you know, rooftop solar and all those, you know, you see the airports with all those solar panels. But you deal with solar, and I heard maybe you were going to do something at the radio stations.
Yeah, we hope to get some solar panels up on the radio station transmission hut and power the transmitter from solar. Yeah.
Okay, so the and which station is that?
It's WGRN for Green.
And also it's WGRN, but also this appears on WCRS
of
as
course.
Well. I'm supposed
there
to
you go.
We're supposed
there
you to go. Announce that WCRS.
That's right. Yes, I was reminded that the
original
the
Pacifica
too.
Affiliate here
right.
in town.
Mm-hmm. All right. Right.
And also we want to remind people that Eugene Beer will speak at the Salon at 1021 East Broad Street on Saturday.
And you can see him on the street playing keyboards on occasion.
And what is that date on Saturday? November 10th.
10th. Yes. And what will you be speaking about that evening?
At 6:30. He'll probably be speaking at 7:30.
7:30. Okay.
But the Salon, sponsored by the Free Press, will... I'll be going on.
And I'll be showing some videos about what I talked about today.
Okay.
Showing
great.
Methane leaks, you know, and people coughing and walking around dazed from the methane leaks.
Yeah, good news. Oh, boy. Well, thanks anyway. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, pleasure.
Sure enough. Hey, Bob, before we finish up, though, you brought up your partner for half a second. I wanted to mention that she underachieved or overachieved. What, the Greens and the Libertarians came in 1 percentile plus a few points.
Yeah, the Greens will be eliminated from the ballot.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And again, our system is really not designed. You know, we have no proportional representation. So our system is designed for lesser evilism. Generally, you end up voting against who you detest the most instead of, you know, who you want the most. So third parties, be they Libertarians or Greens, never quite do well in the United States. Now, if we had instant runoff voting, you could write for your first vote. If it doesn't, you know, it's not one of the top two, it drops down, or proportional representation. But it looks like we're wrapping up.
Yep.
Eugene, thanks a lot for sharing your information.
Other side of the news. Thank you very much.
WGRN. Thanks for listening to The Other Side of the News. This is Bob Fitrakis.
And Dan Dugan, WGRN 94.1 LPFM, The Green Renaissance.